What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Bronx Attorney Broadcast. Today we have Christina Gullo. Christina is a partner at the Cantor Gullo Law Firm, and she's a board member at the Trial Academy. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you, Will. Thanks for having me.
Is there anything in your resume that I forgot to mention there that you're a part of?
No, I think you hit on everything. The Academy has been, probably what's taking up most of my time in the best way lately. So I'm glad you hit on that.
Yeah, we're in a bit of a Trial Academy streak here. We have like four or five in a row where everybody is involved with it. But I guess that just goes to show how much we like it and how much we see the benefit in it.
Absolutely.
And we'll get into that, everything that you've done with the Trial Academy, because I know you're super involved. But first, tell me a little bit about, I was looking at your LinkedIn before. And I saw that you were a legal clerk at your current firm. And you went from legal clerk all the way to partner in like less than 10 years, right?
It's been a bit of a blur, but I clerked here starting my 1L year in law school, and I just look back and I just feel so fortunate that it was just like kind of serendipitous. I saw a posting, I applied, and at the time I was so I had such blinders on. I was like, I'm gonna do family law. I thought that was all I was gonna do, but I was a poor law student. I needed to pay my rent. This paid well. So I went into this job with Steve Cantor, who's now my partner, and it's personal injury, and again, just something that I never saw myself doing. And I just look back and I'm so fortunate things just happened the way they did. Obviously we work hard, but there's always a little bit of luck in that. And had I not, met Steve all the way back when, I don't think I'd be in the position I am now.
What made you so interested in family law initially?
I just loved the concept. I truly believed, and I don't think I'm totally wrong, but at the time, I thought that was the best way to help people. I was actually a history major in undergrad, and then when I realized I didn't want to be a professor, I got a clerkship at family court. So that was my first time seeing the inside of a courtroom. So that was really my first exposure, and I just saw, good people at some of the worst times in their life, which is really not that different from personal injury. I just hadn't experienced it yet. And, I saw the kids that really needed help. And I thought that was going to be my way to really make a difference in my community. And I did do that for a while. I did that after law school. But we always find our way back to what we're supposed to do, I guess.
And I would say family law is one of those things that's similar to personal injury or real estate or, estate planning, where you're working with somebody who is actually like an everyday person that you could bump into in the supermarket, a family, a friend. So many of our former, law school classmates are working for major companies, right? And I think, at least for me, I always wanted to work with, the everyday person.
Absolutely. And I do think that's lend itself so well into personal injury. And I'm so grateful that I had. So right out of law school, I worked at legal aid. I was essentially, for lack of a better term, like a public defender, in the sense that I worked on a grant that I was in court every day, all day. And I had my first hearing, I think, the week after I was admitted, because I had a student practice order previously. And I think if I look back, and I'm so grateful, because if I was not thrown into court in that way, I believe I would have just been so hesitant or, reluctant to try as I got farther into my career. So, just a lot of the same really fundamental principles that helped you connect with family law clients, I really do find to be the same with personal injury clients. It's good people on their worst days.
And what do you think it was about working there that, or what do you think you did that kind of let you be elevated to this position of partner very, very quickly? And I know a lot of small business owners don't really want to be adding new partners, and they want to keep owning a firm to themselves. So, what was it about you and the work that you were doing that you think major partner want to bring you in?
So again, I got to give a lot of credit to my partner, Steve Cantor. He really has, he, you know, vouched for me in a field and that wasn't necessarily the most welcoming to women. We represent a railroad union in New York City. We re represent motorcycle riders, and he kind of championed me in a way. I've always, I think we've always had a great working relationship, and we are like-minded in the way that we want to help people. Where I'm sure this is really similar to you in your practice, because we've had a lot of conversations, you and I, Will, and you know, we're not afraid to give clients our cell phone numbers. You know, we don't just work 9 to 5. If people need us on a weekend or after work, you know, we do that because we actually care about helping these people. So we had a lot in common, but I give him a lot of credit for not only championing me, but also seeing the need for a succession plan. You know, he didn't want to wait, I think, until the last minute, and then, you know, what happens to his legacy. So just always going to be so grateful for him to making sure his legacy goes on, and I'm going to do that the best way that I can, even though he's still practicing.
So you mentioned two of your practice areas that I know are pretty unique. First, with the motorcycle cases, there's different laws that affect the motorcycle cases. Your motorcycle riders are a different demographic than, say, bicycle riders or people who are involved in car accidents. How do you think you have to approach these motorcycle cases differently than, say, your average motor vehicle accident?
I think you have to go into these cases understanding that there's at a baseline a bias against people that are riders, and it's in my experience so unfounded. But you have to go into it realizing they're just like everyone else. You know, it's like the people on the bikes, that's someone's dad, that's someone's mom, that's, you know, I just think that I've seen it firsthand so often. Everywhere, just from the accident happens and the police are at the scene, and you know, there's often this bias that begins that early on and can go all the way, you know, to a jury trial and the jurors that are on the panel. So just like approaching it like these are just people's family members and not, you know, looking past the leather vest. And it was something that, you know, I didn't have anyone in my family that rode, so it was really new to me. And then when I started working with Steve, he was been riding since like the early 2000s, and I remember that I had my first trial coming up on a motorcycle case, and I was like, how am I going to explain to a jury, you know, to how, you know, this accident happened, how to get past their bias, unless I know how to ride myself. So I took a course, I got my license, I eventually got my first bike. And I think that goes to like this, you know, working away at that stigma that these are other people. And like, no, this is your family member. This can be anyone. And just because they're riding doesn't mean they deserve to be injured.
And when you're talking about bias, are you also, in my mind, when I think about that, especially with jurors, having them walk in with a preconceived notion about who's at fault in an accident. And so is that something, does that help shape the way that you build your case, thinking about, people do have negative perceptions of motorcycle riders and a potential juror might think that your client's at fault simply because they were on a motorcycle?
Absolutely. And it's something that, you know, from our intake all the way, you know, into depositions, it's part of how we build our cases and, you know, weaving in the safety components. Here in Buff, I'm in Buffalo, and I can think of one specific area, you know, that's like notorious for people on bikes doing, you know, no helmets, doing wheelies. It's that's what people picture when they picture motorcycle riders. They're not picturing, you know, what is the majority of our clients that took a safety riding class, you know, to get their license, that, you know, are treating this bike like it's a family member. They don't see that. So that's, yes, that's a bias that even from intake, we're asking, you know, what courses did you take? How long have you been riding? Even before you were riding a motorcycle, were you on dirt bikes? And we make sure to weave that into their story and make sure that that's elicited, even when the other attorney at a deposition might not know to ask those questions.
Gotcha. And so the other practice area that I think is pretty niche that you're heavily involved in is your railroad cases. I'd never heard of somebody working on railroad cases the way that you do before, you were telling me about it. So what is a railroad case? What constitutes a railroad case? And a lot of times it's railroad workers, right?
Yes. So we specifically represent injured railroad workers. Our firm is really closely tied with the Metro North Railroad, but specifically the Acre Union. So Metro North, as you know, it's a passenger rail. And what's really unique about railroad cases is that there's no workers' compensation if you are injured while working on the railroad. And that dates all the way back, more than a century, because it was such a dangerous profession and it remains a pretty dangerous profession. So, they wanted to essentially force these railroads to make it as safe for their workers as possible by giving them, they had to have skin in the game. So, when you are injured on the railroad, you have to bring a suit under the FELA, the Federal Employers Liability Act. And that's what makes these cases so unique. There's just so, It's so much inside baseball that, again, I've been really fortunate enough to not only learn from Steve, but through my relationship with our union members, that I'm like lucky enough to call friends at this point. But what I think I love about it is that it's something different every single day. I mean, the way that these injuries can range. I mean, we've dealt with electrocutions. We've dealt with, something as you know, I don't want to say simple, but something as straightforward as falling into a gap or, slipping on ballast. It's just, there's always something different and I'm never bored. So I'm always so grateful that this was something that I also didn't even know existed until I met Steve, until I started to learn about this area of work.
And so for these, under this federal law, do you need to prove that somebody is responsible, is liable like you normally would in a say a motor vehicle accident?
Yeah, so that's, the big distinction between a workers' comp statute where it's you're working, you're injured, you can recover. Under the FELA, there is a standard of negligence. It is a more relaxed standard. It's negligence even in the slightest, which makes it sound easy. It's definitely not easy, but it's very different than any other type of workplace injury. So it is really important that these workers get attorneys because they're up against a higher standard than anyone else in any workplace.
And does it provide for them to recover for all the normal things that you could in a negligence action?
Yep, lost wages, pain and suffering, if there's, out-of-pocket expenses. But what's interesting is that, these railroad workers, they have oftentimes a very good pension. So when they're out and they're missing this time, they're losing on, their pensionable earnings and the fringe benefits. So those are all things that are recoverable. Sick days, things like that.
Got it. And what amount of your practice would you say is devoted to, motorcycle cases, railroad cases, and then, the more common things that we see as personal injury attorneys?
I would say, so the motorcycle cases, they're more seasonal, obviously. So I would say we're definitely the majority railroad. We have, a strong motorcycle practice, but then, like you mentioned, we obviously have car accident cases. It's always just important, I think, if someone comes to us and it's something within my wheelhouse, we want to help them, even if it's not hurt on a motorcycle or hurt while at work. So we do have obviously outliers, but yeah, definitely majority would be the railroad cases and then seconded by the motorcycle cases.
And what do you do to strengthen your relationships with those communities?
We have had such a grassroots approach. You and I were talking earlier offline about, advertising and making your presence known. I've always kind of been hesitant, the idea of like a billboard or TV commercial, because I want it to be authentic. So with the motorcycle work locally, we are involved with a lot of local motorcycle clubs and organizations and their charities. We sponsor their runs. People in our office will be riding in the runs. Sometimes we're just, at a stop handing out water. We go to the organizations and, one of the things we like to do, I call it my party trick, which is not that fun, but I will review their insurance declaration pages, like preventatively, to be like, this is what you need, because no fault law does not help you out if you're hurt on a motorcycle. So it's kind of grassroots advertisements in that way. And then with the railroad, it's similar in that, it's all about the relationship. So even though we practice in New York City, we are there every single month, often more than once a month. I'm leaving tomorrow. I'll be back in 2 weeks. We go to the golf tournaments, we go to union meetings, and we just are there not only for railroad injury needs. If one of the members, again, like I have a case that a member, got in a car accident, we'll handle that, or we'll make sure if it's something that's out of my wheelhouse, we make sure we get it into the right hands.
So you mentioned something that I think is very important that I didn't know until I had my first case with a client on a motorcycle, where if you purchase car insurance in the state of New York, you have to, the insurance that you purchase necessarily comes with what's called no fault insurance, which pays for your medical expenses if you're involved in a car accident, right? Regardless if you're at fault, the insurance that you purchased will pay for your medical expenses up to a certain amount. How does that differ for motorcycles?
I always say this is probably this conversation is I consider it to be one of the worst parts of my job when it comes to the motorcycle cases. I go to sign up a client. These injuries are so severe. Like oftentimes, we're talking amputations, and I meet with the client. I eventually get the insurance policies, and then I have to have the conversation that no fault, which applies to pedestrians, bicycle riders, car accidents, and it's that automatic right to have, medical covered, lost wages covered. That does not apply if you're injured on a motorcycle. So if you're injured on a motorcycle, your right to recovery is going against the insurance of the at fault driver. And the problem with that is, often the people that are driving negligently don't have the highest insurance policies. So that's why, one of the things we just talked about of me going out to like local organizations and clubs and having the insurance talk is explaining the one way that you can really protect yourself, at least financially, is by having this insurance called SUM, supplemental uninsured motorist coverage. That would allow you, that's a policy that you have on your own insurance that you could go against to get to assert a claim against and just have more of a recovery than you might have against the other driver. But again, like I we get these clients that are so severely injured, their life will never be the same. And then I have to explain to them, like, the other driver only had the New York State minimums of 25, and that's not even covering an ambulance bill nowadays. So yeah, I think that's what makes these motorcycle cases an extra layer of difficult, is that what they're entitled to is often limited.
And what brought you to becoming involved with the Trial Academy?
So being at a smaller firm, it's with Steve and I've always kind of, well, Steve has been an incredible partner and mentor. I missed the days of just having like collaborative, blackboarding meetings. And it started with my dear friend Michael Solomon saying, hey, we're starting an associate board. He pulled me into that, and I'm so grateful for that, because it's provided this atmosphere that, I mean, it started off as just kind of like colleagues from across the state, and now I'm lucky enough to call a lot of you guys friends. Like, well, you've helped me already. I hope that someday I can, help you with a case down in my neck of the woods. But
Yeah, for
it's
sure.
just like the collaborative nature has been something that I didn't even really know I was missing until, We started all these projects, and it's just been like such a great resource, and I'm thankful to Michael every day for saying, "Hey, I'm starting this board. You should really pop on." And we've never looked back.
Yeah, I think about how when I was in law school, I had a good group of friends and we used to go get in the library and like all yell at each other about hypotheticals and things like that. And when I was working at a small firm where it was just me and one other attorney, I felt like that was something that I was missing, that getting involved in the associate board kind of like filled that, what I was missing in that area for me.
Absolutely. It's just even like things as basic as value, like when you're like trying to figure out what to demand on a case, you never want to be in a vacuum. And this has been such a great, resource for that. And not even just talking things through, but having referrals, like I said, you practice where a lot of my clients live. So like I know that if I need to, if there's a case that's just not really in my wheelhouse, like I can say confidently, like I can pass this along to you, Will, because I can tell these people that they're going to be in great hands.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I don't know how many trips I'll be wanting to take up to Buffalo. So if anybody calls me
I
from up
don't blame
there,
you.
I know who to call.
Every time I look out the window and I see the snow pile next to the window, I'm like, why am I here?
One of the things that you were heavily involved in with the Trial Academy was special term. Can you tell us what special term is?
Yeah, and I was thinking about it when you had told me yesterday you were kind of caught in court all day. So special term start is a project that Carrie Beyer, who's also with the Academy, and I started. It was really in the throes of COVID when, courtrooms were essentially closed. And we were like, how are young attorneys and law students going to learn what it's like to be in court? Because when we started our practices, one of the things, at least in Western New York, that was really common was is that there would be motion practice, and it would be a cattle call type of situation. Everyone's time was 9:30. Everyone would show up. You would wait until your adversary got there, then you check in, and then in the meantime, though, other cases would be going, and that just provided this opportunity to sit and watch, and not only watch the judge, but watch the other attorneys and kind of like assess styles and figure out what kind of lawyer you wanted to be. And it was just so helpful. And then, COVID happens, everything in person is taken away, and it's like, what are people doing to like learn? I just remember not even knowing it, my first couple times in court, I was like, where do I stand? Like things that are that basic, that how do you really know that if you're just, learning virtually in a classroom? So we started this program that was, it started by live streaming motion arguments. And then we were really fortunate enough to get the support of a Nassau County judge, Judge Cousins, that was able to, allowed us to live stream his jury, summary jury trial. So there was a lot of things that like couldn't be done. Like we couldn't show jurors' faces, we couldn't show jury selection, but we were able to, and are able to, live stream opening arguments, direct, cross, closings, and then have everyone see what the verdict is. So it's been a pretty cool experience. And obviously, and thankfully that, we're not in a COVID era anymore and the courtrooms have opened up, there's still not that many opportunities to see trials. They're few and far between, but especially for newer attorneys and law students. And I think it's just so crucial to figuring out if that's something you want to do and how you want to do it.
Yeah, and I think that when you're in law school and you're interning or maybe college, and you're at a district attorney's office, public defender, insurance company, they all know when the trials are happening, and you'll be sent to go watch those trials because of how important it is to see how actually it's done, not just the theory that you're learning in law school. And I think that by being able to show new attorneys that might not be working in these types of places where they have access to all these different trials is really helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was just something that I had hoped. I'm a first generation lawyer, so like I didn't have anyone in my family that I was like going to court with or going to their office with. So, We were always like, if this helps, like if five people are watching this, that's five people that wouldn't have seen this. But you know, it's been pretty cool. The turnouts, it's often like hundreds to 1,000 people watching, and you can never fit that many people in a courtroom. So it that always makes me quite happy, and I'm really glad that it's continued to live on, even though we are back to an in-person type of legal atmosphere.
You also mentioned not knowing where to stand, and I think back to like the first time that I had to go to court, and it was just for a conference, and I walk in and there's all these attorneys there, like 50, 60 attorneys, and they're all like yelling and like running around the room, and it's like, what is going on in here? And like for the longest time, it was like I couldn't figure out how to conference my case or how to find my adversary or whatever it was, just because it's not something that anybody ever, teaches you how to do. And I always tell new attorneys, like the trick that I still use when I'm in a new courtroom is like find the court officer and be like, what are the rules here? Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, please help me.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you find someone with kind eyes and you're like, just give me a hint. But it's funny because I, even to this day, it's like I know that I am such an over-preparer that when it comes to my case, that's not the part that stresses me out. It's like often the admin of it. Like I remember, you know, every time I'm going to like a courthouse for my first time, I'm there so early because I'm like, what if? What if I'm on the wrong floor? What if, you know? So I think that that's what I, one of the purposes of special term was kind of taking that guesswork out, is just seeing, okay, plaintiff stands closest to the jury box and things like that. That if we can teach someone that, I feel like that's well worth it.
Another thing that I saw on your LinkedIn was, I know you've written about and you've talked a lot about how fitness is so important to integrate into practicing law as well.
Yeah.
And why do you think that is? And how do you incorporate the two together?
I often wonder if it's, I don't, I would like to think it's not just me that feels this way, but I am somewhat, I grew up really competitive. I played D1 soccer in school. And it's always been such a part of my life that it is fitness and working out is what I believe keeps me grounded. It like gives me a mental clarity to the point that like if I don't work out in the morning, I'm just noticing that through the day, like I might be a little bit testier. Like I might, you know, things like that. I just think it's one of the few things that you can really do for yourself. And, you know, our job is to take on other people's problems and traumas. And I think if you're not kind of implementing some form of self-care, it's not going to bode well for you in your career because it's just a lot, I think, to bear.
And you have you running a half marathon
Yeah, I'm doing,
soon?
yeah, it's like maybe a little too soon. It's March 15th. It's the
Wow,
United.
that's and today's March 3rd, so you better be ready.
I'm as best as I can. Yeah, I'm really proud of this one. It's not, I've done a few of these, but this is my second time running the United Airlines half marathon in New York, and I'm running in support of the MS Foundation. One of my best friends from college, she was diagnosed with MS right after school, and this is just someone that's like incredibly active and, you know, eats well and everything, and all the funds that we raise go to support the MS Foundation. So it's always been a special one for me. And like, how cool is it that you get to run over the Brooklyn Bridge? I feel like that was, and I'm a little bit of a nerd, so like I'll play the Hamilton soundtrack as I'm like running over the Brooklyn Bridge and you're on the FDR. So I'm excited about this one.
Well, good luck. We're rooting for
Thank you. Just gotta finish, right?
you.
Really low bars as I'm getting older.
Another thing I know about you that can be difficult to balance with law practice is you are a new mom.
Yeah,
What
which is
so
like,
what's that been like?
I have the most rambunctious little 1-year-old. He just turned one, and I like don't know how. It definitely, I think it's put a lot of things into perspective. I was just talking to one of my friends, and it's like things that I conversations with adversaries, you know, that may have like stayed with me through the day. Now I'm like, it's all about perspective, you know. It's been the most challenging thing that I've ever done, and it's also like the most fulfilling thing. And I just am like so. I just want to impress upon him that he's always going to have to work. So it was really tough. I think the transition of, being a partner and running a business and having him. Unfortunately, I didn't get that much time off, but he would come to the office with me until he could walk. Once he started like or crawling, then it was like, this isn't working. But there's days where, we had a litigation lab session, and my secretary is so kind. She's the best. And she was like, bring him in. I'll watch him for this hour because we didn't have coverage. And when they say it like takes a village, they are not joking. So this little guy is just going to grow up thinking that, when I'm traveling, it's like, oh, mom's at a deposition. I don't think we're going to have a lot of attachment or like, he's not going to be worried about where I am because he's been experiencing it from a young age.
Well, it was a lot of fun hearing, all about you and your practice today. If anybody's listening to this and they want to reach out to you about, motorcycle cases, railroad cases, getting involved in the Trial Academy, watching Special Term, how can people find you or reach out?
So the firm is Cantor-Gallo Law Firm. We're in Buffalo, but we practice throughout the state. So give me a call at 716-626-0404. Look me up on LinkedIn, and it's just been such a pleasure. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you, and I'll see you soon.